and welcome to Maybridge Community Church Online. Whether it's your first time exploring faith, or you're new to us, or you're a regular at Maybridge, just tuning in for a cheeky bit of extra content, we are really glad you're here. My name is Chloe and I'm part of the staff team at Maybridge Community Church. Make sure you hit like and subscribe so you don't miss out on any of our online resources. If you would like to give as part of your worship, you can do so by heading to maybridge.org.uk/give. But of course, there's absolutely no pressure to do so. We are just glad you're here and we hope that you find this resource useful and helpful. For more information about faith, church family life, events, gatherings, anything that makes the Maybridge world go round, head to maybridge.org.uk or get in touch at info@maybridge.org.uk. Enjoy.
I'm Matt, the minister here at Maybridge Community Church. Great to have you with us. We're continuing our long, but I think very worthwhile, look at Matthew's Gospel today as part of our Radical King series. And the whole point is that we encounter the real Jesus through the text and we're challenged to live life in his ways in our context. We've been looking at Matthew chapter 12 for a few weeks. A lot of it is a very intense conversation Jesus has with a group called the Pharisees. They are at the time a very influential group of religious leaders in Israel. And interestingly, they don't like Jesus, but they don't say that Jesus doesn't have miraculous power, which people might say now. They say, we know you have power, Jesus. We just think that it's satanic. So it's quite a big accusation. And then today escalates in Matthew 12 from verse 38 to 45. We're going to break it down bit by bit and then look at the whole thing together. So in verse 38, it says, "Then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, 'Teacher, we want to see a sign from you.'" Now, it was already, I reckon, quite a tense moment. These are heavyweight religious people. They're like the theology police of the country. This is in public. A group of them are surrounding Jesus, Pharisees and teachers of the law. These are the experts. And they address Jesus as teacher, which is a bit weird because that's a respectful title. And just a moment ago, they called him a representative of Satan. And many people think that maybe they said teacher sort of sarcastically, because the aim we'll see here is not an honest search for truth. The aim is to catch Jesus out in some way. So this is a very pressurised moment. What's their request? "We want to see a sign from you." We want a sign. Now, at face value, that seems pretty reasonable. At that point, there was a buzz growing around Jesus. Some people were saying maybe he's the Messiah, this special person promised by the Old Testament. The crowds are all over the place. So on one level, you think, well, fair enough. Come on, Jesus, we want some sort of proof. You know, pull a rabbit out of a hat or something and then we'll be convinced. That's what's meant by a sign, some sort of indication that he's more than a normal bloke. The thing is, this is a little bit late in the day to ask for a sign. This is Matthew chapter 12, not chapter 1. By this point, Jesus has already healed a paralysed man, healed a dead girl and a sick woman, healed a blind man and a mute man, healed a man with leprosy, he's healed a centurion's servant, he's healed Peter's mother-in-law, he's calmed a storm, he's cast demons out of people, he's healed loads and loads and loads of others. That's why the crowds are around him in the first place. He was already doing miracles. It was sort of his day job. And the people are now asking for a sign, knowing virtually all of this. They know all the things I've just said. In fact, they were present for most of it. Asking Jesus for a sign at this moment is like when my children come and say, "You never give me a treat. I want treats." And you're like, "Well, what, you had an ice cream like 11 minutes ago? This is absolutely ridiculous." And especially when they'd already seen what Jesus was doing, and they've already accused him of doing with satanic power. What is it they want? More demonstrations of Satan? What they actually want is for Jesus to make a mistake. They want him to say the wrong thing, to do the wrong thing. Whatever he does next, they will try to twist. Have you ever been in that situation where you know whatever you do, you can't win? You just know that other person will assume the worst motives or they'll criticise you or something, and it's extremely frustrating. That's what's being directed at Jesus in this conversation. And it still happens to this day with Jesus. People say things like, "Well, I don't believe in Jesus, I don't believe in God. If he did a miracle in front of me, I believe him, otherwise I'm not." But we know that isn't how it works. Lots of people back then saw Jesus do miracles, including these Pharisees, and they don't believe him because the sort of belief we're talking about isn't just agreeing with some facts and observations, it's placing trust in a person. There's more to that than simply having something you can't explain happen in front of you. There was a big debate a few years ago. One of those ones where they get heavyweight academics in and they sell tickets between William Lane Craig, a Christian philosopher, and Lewis Wolpert, a biologist and an atheist. And the moderator was John Humphreys, the journalist, you may know from TV. And he's an agnostic, but he's interested in the issue. And during the debate, he said to Lewis Wolpert, "Well, what would it take for you to believe in God?" And Wolpert said, "Well, I'd need a miracle. Show me a miracle, a sign, and I'll believe." Which sounds like a good answer, but John Humphreys, being a great journalist, wouldn't let him go on this. He said, "Well, surely, given everything else you've said, you'd just say a miracle was something you have no explanation for yet. Your prior beliefs wouldn't allow you to conclude that it pointed to God." And Wolpert had to concede that that was true, which is fascinating because, in other words, Wolpert was saying, "I'm not open to anything to do with God. My pre-existing beliefs will not allow it. I'm closed to evidence, reasoning, experience, anything at all." It's quite shocking for a scientist if you really think about it. And actually what was true of Lewis Wolpert was true of the first century Pharisees. Yes, they believed Jesus was doing the miraculous, great, but they didn't trust him. This was, and always will be, less about evidence and more about attitude of the heart. And Jesus was fully aware of this. Plenty of people saw the miracles but didn't follow him at all. And plenty of people through history have seen no miracles and yet given up their lives to follow him. It's more than a mechanical response to what you see before your own eyes. And the thing is, it's not just atheistic secular skeptics who say in their hearts, "Jesus, give me a sign, prove yourself to me." All of us have it in us to do the same thing. I'm not talking about the person in desperate need who says, "Please God, help me now, I need something." I'm talking about the person who sits there, arms folded, saying, "The creator of the universe, you've got to prove yourself to me. You must prove yourself to me." We've all got it in us. But let's look at how Jesus responds. Will Jesus say something really gentle and sensitive and pastoral? Not this time. But as so often with Jesus, these are strong words that come from love. We live in a society that says strong words and love are not compatible. But that's patently ridiculous. Look at what Jesus says. He answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment of this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now something greater than Jonah is here." So he begins with some very stern words. A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign. Isn't that a bit harsh? In Jewish thought at the time, the phrase "wicked and adulterous generation" was quite a well-known phrase, a common phrase, and it simply meant that you were opposing God. And there's a reason it's those two words. Firstly, wicked meant evil, sort of in the old-fashioned sense. Asking for a sign in this case was not a genuine inquiry. Jesus is saying it's a demonstration of evil. Really strong pushback. And where we often think of evil as rape and murder and terrible stuff like that, the heart of evil, the underlying issue, is opposition to God's ways. And by saying, "Jesus, you must prove yourself to us," the Pharisees were committing a type of evil towards God. They're not truth seekers, they're power seekers. They want him to dance to their tune. They want him to fit in with their view of reality. Secondly, adulterous means, as it does now, but in Jewish thought, the relationship God was supposed to have with his people was like a husband and wife. And when a husband or a wife betrays their spouse for someone else, what is that? It's adultery. And so to describe them as adulterous was to say, "You're breaking the relationship. We're supposed to have a loving, committed relationship, but by asking for a sign, in the way you're doing it, you're demonstrating that you don't trust me. Your trust lies elsewhere." And so these words of Jesus are strong, but they're not just a violent outburst. They're loaded with emotional investment and concern. It's the idea of a broken relationship that bothers him. He's heartbroken by their attitude, their behaviour. We know from the last chapter these guys were plotting to eventually kill him, and he knew it too. But beyond the emotions, his response is to say, "I'm going to give you no sign except for the greatest sign you could possibly get." And the sign is that Jesus will sort of repeat the story of Jonah, but do it better. The Old Testament story of Jonah, you may or may not know it, or most of the story, is that God tells Jonah to go to a city called Nineveh, and they're in a really bad way. They've been doing terrible things for hundreds of years, and Jonah's supposed to go and speak against them. And he doesn't want to, so he runs off, he gets on a boat, he ends up in a massive storm, and then he realises that he's responsible for all of this somehow, and he sacrifices himself. He gets the sailors to throw him overboard where he ends up being swallowed by a big sea creature. And 3 days later, he gets vomited upon the shore and he survives this strange and terrible thing. And it's a really interesting story on its own. But now, much later, Jesus says, that story has a whole other level. It's a pointer to what I'm going to do. Because he is the Son of Man that he refers to. That was an Old Testament title. And what he will do is die for 3 days as well, but actually completely die, and then rise again. In the original story, Jonah eventually did go to Nineveh. He did speak to them about what they were doing. And amazingly, the city en masse repented. They turned back from what they were doing. And Jesus is now saying to the Pharisees, look, the Ninevites only had Jonah, not me. And they still repented. In fact, the Ninevites didn't even see Jesus escape the sea creature, that which would have been quite compelling. They just heard his message. Jesus is saying, you know, you've got me and my miracles and my message, and yet you won't budge. So when the judgment of God happens to you one day, those guys will be better off than you. They responded better than you. Now, this for us, this creates a question that is very much located in our culture. Isn't this a bit much, all this talk of judgment and who's better positioned for? Isn't Jesus supposed to be loving to everybody? Well, look at the posture of Jesus throughout this. These men want to kill him, and his ultimate response is to knowingly, deliberately die on their behalf, the sign of Jonah, warning them and us about judgment is an act of love. People who love themselves more than they love you will not challenge you or disagree with you. They can't be bothered. Jesus will disagree with you and challenge you to the innermost part of who you are, your deepest motives and ideas, out of love. You can't question the love, not really, because he died and rose again for you. The position Jesus takes here is like when there's been a car accident on the motorway and the police park behind it and put all the flashing lights on to tell everybody to sort of drive around. And the police aren't doing that, of course, because they want to mess up your journey. They're doing it for your own good. To say that they were imposing on your feelings or your free choice would be completely absurd. And that's what Jesus is like with judgment. He doesn't want anyone to suffer on that day. It's why he came in the first place. And that's why Jesus' response to the Pharisees, the people opposing him most, is I'm not going to give you a sign except for the greatest sign you could possibly get. That's all. It's all based on love. But the tough words do continue. He says, the Queen of the South will rise at judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now something greater than Solomon is here. Little fact for you, the football team Queen of the South, who play in the Scottish Championship, can claim to be the only British football team mentioned in the Bible. But I've done some research, I've looked at the books, and I'm pretty sure that's not who Jesus is talking about in this passage. The Queen of the South was actually the Queen of Sheba from the Arabian Peninsula, and basically 1,000 years before Jesus is speaking, she was a rich and powerful leader who came to Israel to meet with King Solomon because he had become famous for having great wisdom. And so she comes and asks him loads of hard questions, presumably. And Jesus adds to what he said about Jonah by saying something these religious leaders would have hated. The Queen of Sheba, who was both a woman and not Jewish, so from their point of view, not as good as them, the Queen of Sheba had the humility and the intelligence that despite her power and influence, she travelled to chat with Solomon because she recognised that he had something special, that God's hand was on him somehow, yet he had this extraordinary wisdom and insight into life. And so just like the Ninevites, Jesus says, this queen is in a better place than you on Judgment Day, because not only did she have Solomon and she responded, well, you've got one better, you've got me, and you still won't. Now combine these two things together, and Jesus' response to the request for a sign is to say something like this. It's, I'm greater than Jonah, and I'm greater than Solomon, a prophet and a king. Someone who gave his life and came back for others, although they've not seen this yet, and someone who had sublime insight into the mysteries of life. Remind you of anybody? And he's saying, I'm greater than both of them. You've got me right here. You know, you've seen a pile of miracles and you still want a sign? And now we could stop there. But the next thing Jesus says sounds unrelated, but actually it's very unrelated, and I'll explain why. He continues, when an impure spirit comes out of a person, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I'll return to the house I left. When it arrives, it finds the house unoccupied, swept clean and put in order. Then it goes and takes with it 7 other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the final condition of that person is worse than the first. That is how it will be with this wicked generation. So right at the end of the passage, Jesus says, the final condition of that person is worse than the first. This is how it will be with this wicked generation. And that mirrors at the beginning where it said, a wicked and adulterous generation ask for a sign. And that tells us that all this is on the same topic. This is all part of the same response. Now, what's going on here? We live in a time and place where people are very understandably sceptical about the existence of demons. That's what impure spirits in this passage are. But everyone in the first century did believe in them, including Jesus. And as we've already said, the Pharisees thought that Jesus was using demonic power. It was quite common at this point, if you were accused of something in a public teaching context, which this is, to return the accusation back round to the other people. But Jesus doesn't quite do that. They say, you've got demonic power. And he replies with a lesser accusation. Basically, you're open to being influenced by demonic power. This is important. What Jesus says in this paragraph tells us something really significant about human nature. The Pharisees think the big enemy we face in life is demons. It's Satan, the devil. If we didn't have demons around, we'd be fine. Now, we can see that they think this because of how they accuse Jesus. And now, they're right, obviously, they're right to be concerned about demons. Demonic things aren't good. The Pharisees, like many people, massively overestimate their own capability for goodness and left to their own devices. And what Jesus does with this story is say, well, imagine a person who was under demonic influence and the demon left. And while the demon's gone, that person gets their life on track. Maybe they make some good decisions. They do the right things. They get cleaned up a bit, you know, a bit like cleaning up your house. All good so far. But Jesus calls the house in the story unoccupied. In other words, it's vulnerable. And then seven more demons come in and it's worse than before. The problem was that the house was unoccupied. Sure, it gets cleaned up, it's tidy and spotless, a bit like how the Pharisees are on the outside, but inside, the house is empty. Anything can come in and take over. But what's the point of this? The point is that the inner reality of your life is the thing that matters the most. The Pharisees were the most religious people around. They were organised and strict, they knew every law, they've got spreadsheets of it all, extensive lists of rules. From the outside, they're the people that are doing well. They live comfortable, upright lives, but they're vulnerable. Something will eventually occupy their inner lives. It's a question of what. And so what Jesus implies to these people who are very concerned about demons is, well, yeah, you'd be concerned about demons, sure. The real issue is you need a power in your life that is greater than the power of demons. If you don't have that, every outward reform in the world will mean nothing because you're vulnerable. The house needs to be occupied, so to speak, by someone who is greater than Satan. What the Pharisees need, of course, is to be occupied by Jesus. Rather than pushing him away and suspiciously accusing him of things, they need to invite him in. They need, and it's a radical thing that Jesus implies, to hand their lives over to him for their own good. Why? Because he is the one who was a greater and better Jonah who rose after 3 days, and a greater and better Solomon who understood life like nobody else. He's also the one who's demonstrated the power to cast out demons. Who else are you going to turn to? And so, what are we supposed to do with this passage? Probably none of us are a first century Pharisee who suspects Jesus of being in league with Satan. Guess that's not any of us. But the central warnings Jesus gives apply to anyone. And I think the passage shows us too are like little red lights on the dashboard. And if the idea of warning sounds a bit negative, remember they're there to stop us missing out on something good. That's the goal. Warning light one is asking for a sign. And for us, this maybe doesn't come out in the same way it does for the Pharisees, but the underlying issue for us is probably when in our hearts we say, God, prove yourself to me, impress me, show me again that you're worthy of my time. Now, of course, God is gracious and loving and he lowers himself to our level in 100 ways, but he doesn't need to prove himself to you or me. And it might come out when we say to God, I won't do this until you do this. I won't be generous with my money until you make sure I have more. I won't love my spouse until you make them a bit nicer. I won't worship you until you resolve this really painful thing I'm dealing with. It doesn't work like that. A number of times in the Bible, people ask God for a sign, usually when they're anxious about something, and quite often, God does this really frustrating thing of saying, I'll give you the sign after you've done the thing I've already asked you to do, which feels like it ruins the point of a sign. And I think it's God's way of saying, trust me as a person, not what you think I can do for you and your own agenda. Trust me as a person. And so where are you holding out on trusting God at the moment? Where are you saying to him, give me what I want first and I'll believe you. Then I'll follow you when you give me my agenda. Second warning light, the unoccupied house. What Jesus gets out of the story of the house and the demons is why Christianity is at root far more than just about being a nicer person. Everybody wants to be a nicer person, don't they? But when it comes down to it, we can fix up the outside, but not the pesky inside. You can change your name, your appearance, your job, your friends, everything. You can try hard to be as good as possible, but you'll still be you. And the warning here is about overconfidence in our own ability to sort our house out. And that might be right you right now. I think it's all of us at some point. We're all a little bit Pharisee in our own ways. We slide so easily into our performance, keeping up appearances, projecting the lie that we have it all together. But in this inside, we're self-dependent and anxious, and we don't trust God in our inner life. That, I would suggest, is when we're at our most vulnerable. When outwardly we're doing okay, no big crisis, no felt need to depend on Jesus for anything. We've got health and careers and no obvious moral failures in our lives. Everything seems to be fine. Maybe that is when we're at our most vulnerable. The house is clean and tidy, but it's unoccupied. And Jesus does not mince his words around this stuff. He specifically calls it evil in this passage. Have you ever thought that living a comfortable, untroubled, outwardly respectable, Instagram-friendly, middle-class life is the sort of thing that Jesus might call evil? If a life without God at the centre of it is what's going on. Nobody else says this sort of thing to you, I'm sure. Only Jesus. Nobody else is as personal. No one else is as direct. No one else is as clear about your sin. But nobody else will give you the sign of Jonah either. So what are you going to do? What do you need to do in response to him right now? Why not spend some time today thinking that through and praying it through? I'll pray now. Father, thank you for Jesus. Thank you that he does give the sign of Jonah. He did rise again after 3 days. And thank you that we can trust him for that reason. And I pray that as we go through our day, go through our week, we would just face some home truths. You know, where is our trust? What is it we're depending on? Is our house unoccupied, so to speak, right now? Thank you that you're loving and gracious. And whatever we've done, you're always willing to come back to us when we've walked away. You're always open to welcoming us back, and we can have that relationship with you from wherever we are right now. Amen.